Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.
This is The Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
All right. Good afternoon and welcome to The Fourth Estate here on Reality Check Radio on Friday, the 5th of July, 2024. I'm your host, Marty Gibson, filling in for Marie Buskey and Alastair Harding. There's plenty of first draft of history stuff for us to chew over today. This is the week New Zealand civilization begins to collapse as we lose News Hub, along with the Sunday news. National pressing on with a fair digital news bargaining bill to address social media companies that use news without paying for it, or without paying much tax for that matter. We'll take a look at the apparent non-newsworthiness of the new improved COVID inquiry and other issues of balance in our public broadcasting, including the continued fallout from the enthusiasm Manurewa Marae apparently had for helping Te Pāti Māori get elected. Luckily, I won't have to do this on my own. Joining us from Auckland is Professor Robert McCulloch, who holds the Matthew S. Abel Chair of Macroeconomics at Auckland University. He's a native of New Zealand and worked at the Reserve Bank of New Zealand before completing his PhD in economics at Oxford University in the UK. Robert is an associate at Principal Economics. He also blogs at Down to Earth Kiwi, a surprising claim given the heady heights of that CV. Good afternoon, Rob.
Good afternoon.
And joining us from Wellington, Catherine Ennis-Carter is a management consultant who specializes in governance, public administration, public sector reform, policy development, including poverty reduction, strategic management, institutional development, capacity building, and public financial management reform. Over the past quarter century, this work has taken around the Pacific Islands, Southeast Asia, Armenia, Jamaica, Pakistan, Turkey, Africa, and Australia, and the USA, as well as New Zealand. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Catherine. I'm sure there's plenty for you to be doing down in Wellington on what I hear is one of those good days you can't beat it on.
Yes. Thank you, Marty, for that introduction covering the the length of the career.
Yeah. It's been one of the biggest stories in New Zealand media this year because it deeply affects people who work in New Zealand media. It's a bit like when the lockdown was on, we got a lot of stories about cafes and hairdressers. This week sees the long-anticipated demise of News Hub. This was a subject of an especially pithy column even for you, Rob, a man famed for his pith. Tell me, how are we going to cope?
Yes, what are we going to do without it? Oh, my God, our lives are never going to be the same. They're measuring sort of national well-being at the moment, and I'd expect national well-being will probably rise upon News Hub's demise. I mean, this is the outlet that never really wanted to ask folks like me anything about economics, but they love folks like Shamabeel Ikwab, who I know a bit, because when you wheel out Shamabeel, you'll get comments like describing the leader of the ACT Party as economically illiterate, which he did, and leading up to the election last year, describing Chris Luxon's proposed budget as bullshit. So we're going to miss all those sort of four-letter words directed at politicians and and insults. I noticed quite fittingly in their last week, they start running, trying to push a big story that, my goodness, David Seymour has actually been replies personally to all the social media and text messages he gets. I know David a bit, and he's probably the hardest working person in Parliament, and he has an ethos of replying to practically every message he gets, you know, and now they held it against him. Gosh, he's replying to school children, trying to cast lurid sort of aspersions on his character for having a work ethic. And I noticed in News Hubs last week, people like Patrick Gower, he's got something up on their website now saying with the word effing about the end, the demise of News Hubs. So wheeling out those four-letter words to describe his career at News Hub. You know, it's effing gone now. You know, not looking at themselves and what they're teaching young people and the impression that they're giving them with all these sorts of abuse and insults. I'm really glad to see the back of it.
Right. Yeah, no, it's interesting, isn't it, how sexualized reading stories to children is all good and
yes,
and replying on a social media platform in a way that was apparently above reproach is a little bit, how was it described, a little bit icky.
Yes, trying to, in fact, Rodney High's got a piece going on another blog on sex education in Kiwi schools, where there are some well-known Kiwi journalists who are doing videos for 13-year-old children to watch with the most lurid, explicit, you know, you couldn't be more explicit in terms of you know, sex for Rodney High's 13-year-old daughter. But that's all okay. But you're a politician. You reply to every text message you get. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that you like replying to your constituents and you get these sort of nasty aspersions in your character. I'm glad to see them.
Yeah. How about you, Catherine? Are you?
Well, I'd have to say that I very much enjoyed Rob's little article on Down to Earth about, you know, how will we manage without News Hub? You said we'll be okay, and you know that's pretty much my opinion. Will we miss it? Well, not so much. but I think you know it does raise the question of, oh dear, we're now left to the mercies of TV1 and Radio New Zealand, which doesn't seem to be a much better prospect, but. I don't think News Hub will be missed very much at all, really.
Yeah, New Zealand didn't ask much of News Hub today. All they wanted was, to my mind at least, was balanced journalism as opposed to the more government and less freedom ideology of 80% of New Zealand's journalists, and a quarter of which who identify as hard left, but 80% identify as left. Was News Hub's problem, do you think, that there was not enough to distinguish them from those public broadcasters sitting even further left, or did they just not cut their cloth to suit the shrinking audience and revenue?
Well, personally, I don't think they picked up on the opportunity to be different. Mm. You know, we've got, you know, we ended up with another version of, you know, if you look at TV1, their approach to news involving government anyway is twofold, and you know we've had, you know, downgrading of standards and any kind of innovation in the media over probably the last couple of decades now, so you know the public has been educated to expect a poor coverage. But basically, you know, if you look at TV1, and I think News Hub is only an extra extrapolation of that, you know, what we get that passes for political commentary is, you know, is, as I said, twofold. First of all, they have a five-point pitchfork approach to reporting any news, particularly, as I say, involving government. So you announce the headline, you give it a negative angle to start with if you can, then you give about a 30-second soundbite to the Prime Minister or key relevant minister. Then you have a selection of 30-second soundbite comments from various pundits or interested parties, all of whom make negative comments about whatever it is that's announced. And then you give Chris Hipkins about 3 minutes to say how terrible whatever it is that's been announced is and how wonderful the Labor Party did with everything they did. And quite frankly, I've never seen a leader of the opposition given as much media time as Chris Hipkins has been getting since the election. And then you revert to the studio where we've got this thing of news presenters who know very little about anything. Most of them are just communications graduates. So they then the TV presenters interview each other and tell the public what to think. And then the second part of their approach is reporting on polls, which they do with alacrity if there's any kind of change in the government's ratings and passively if it's affecting the opposition. So, you know, and News Hub has really only been a slight variation on that kind of approach. So will they be missed? No, because most of the New Zealand public has lost interest and switched off.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of the narcissistic rage we've seen from some of those journalists affected, in particular Paddy Gower, as you mentioned recently, Robert, has been directed at the ungrateful audience who have the audacity to do their own research on the internet and also to social media companies who take content and also funnel revenue they generate offshore to arms of their business overseas that are in more friendly tax environments, ostensibly in exchange for services. This brings us, I guess, to the previous government's attempt to address this was led by New Zealand's Al Sharpton, Willie Jackson, and was named the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill. And Communications Minister Paul Goldsmith on Tuesday confirmed it would progress with amendments. My own feeling is this is because if they started again from scratch, they wouldn't have the same PR chops to give it a highfalutin name. After the way they've pressed on with boot camps, they'd probably call it the "We Smells the Precious and We Wants It" bill. Can we cut open these and extract the golden eggs, or is government meddling just going to delay and distort the much needed evolution of media at great expense to taxpayers and content quality?
Well, you know, the economics of it all is now a big topic. Media economics is a big topic, and the starting point is, in principle, there's nothing wrong with what Willie Jackson or the new government are doing, in that if you create something, then you should be paid for it. And property rights are the basis of market economies. So that's the view in economics is that's why, you know, we've achieved prosperity over the last several hundred years in the market economy. So, you know, if you're the Beatles or producing music to this day, when radio stations play your songs, you get royalties. And that is meant to encourage more innovation and more music producing or better content. So that's the theory behind it. And that's not a bad thing. But when it comes to news content, it seems a very different beast from, say, music. And over a long period of time now, it's been very hard to sell news content. And, you know, if you take, look at some of the reasons for that, one economics example, say the Reserve Bank announces a cut in interest rates. Well, in the old days, maybe you had to send reporters to Wellington and listen to the governor talking. Now they put it on their website. And someone who runs a blog like me can just describe what's happened and the effects on the economy. And many of us would claim to do it much better than the Herald economics correspondent who's never studied economics. So why don't the public just go to the Reserve Bank website, flick on some blogs and, you know, other channels? So they've got an immense competition. And I don't think when it comes to trying to force people to pay, experience has shown us it's going to be very hard to do. And I think they're probably barking up the wrong tree, because they're complaining that this is a change worldwide, that you just can't make money out of selling news. Well, that's been a problem for 20, 30, 40 years. When the Herald, if the Herald was valued now at what it was in 1980, it would be a $3 or $4 billion company. In fact, it's worth virtually nothing today, almost nothing. What's the reason for that? It's not got practically a single thing to do with content. They lost the classifieds. Trade Me took nearly all their classifieds. Trade Me is now a $3 billion company, and all the market value of the Herald went to Trade Me. So in a way, they're complaining, but they've been under actually quite dumb management, and the Kiwi media have not changed with the times. There are other networks in the world. In Norway, this company called Schibsted, and when they saw they were losing classifieds, they did their own trading platform. So now it's all part of the Schibsted, the media empire of that company. And 4 years ago, they bought all the classifieds from eBay. They're now the biggest online marketplace in the world. So if you change with the times, you know, in the new buzzword in media economics is connectivity. You've got to connect the people who are going to you, join them up to trade, buy and sell. I don't think if it's One News, News Hub stuff, they don't join up anyone. In fact, all One News did is say, look, watch every lunchtime for 3 years at Ardern on her podium of truth. Come to us for that and get government advertising. The new game is connecting up your users. And, you know, whether private or public, they haven't done that. So
you could argue they've been alienating.
Sorry?
You could argue they've been alienating their users.
Yes, yes. Mm.
And this is very much your wheelhouse, Catherine, the management aspect of it. And as someone who works with government a lot, you must have to deal with a lot of will by government to distort markets and poke their noses in where maybe they'd be better to stay out and let evolution occur naturally. What's been your view on this?
Well, yeah, kind of. I have mixed feelings about this because there are some instances where government actually needs to intervene in the market in a way that they're not satisfactorily doing. If you're going to have free markets and free market, and you know let that run, then basically what you're going to end up with is the law of the jungle, because the big players will eat up the small players, and it's very difficult to stop that happening. It seems that the reliance on government to regulate the private sector seems to be quite difficult and quite limited, and there's never enough resources put into that anyway. And so we have, you know, what happens with the Commerce Commission and the electricity regulation. Regulating the electricity sector, all those things seem to fall short because the model can never work if you don't have a clear idea of what you're trying to do, and then secondly enough resources to do it properly. So I'm not against the government trying to intervene in the private sector at all. I don't buy into the notion of complete anarchy when it comes to the operation of the private sector, simply because of, you know, the globalist power of large companies to basically evade any kind of regulatory restrictions. But by the same token, when the government does intervene, they need to have a clear sense of what they're trying to do. And if we take this back to the digital news bargaining bill. I'm not clear about what the government's actually trying to do with this. It sounds nice to try and make the big media and tech companies pay for local news content if they're picking that up and using that. But, you know, as with any piece of legislation, there's always fishhooks and, you know, the devil of the detail and unintended consequences sometimes. And, you know, there are a few things about this that already have me thinking, well, what the heck is going on here? And one of them was the statement by Paul Goldsmith that this bill will require the appointment of an independent regulator as the bill's authority. Now, I don't know really what that means, but to me it sounds like signalling, you know, more public servants to be put in place trying to have some kind of monitoring role And this was part of the approach for the so-called safer online services approach that Department of Internal Affairs was trying to get across the line. And so I don't know that setting up more public servants, you know, with a weak piece of legislation will achieve anything at all. And I'm inclined to agree with David Seymour when he says that the bill won't change the fundamental challenge facing the traditional media, and went on to say that it's never been easier to share information online, but people don't want the product on offer. And I tend to think that that's really the core of the problem, as Rob was just saying, the difficulty of trying to make news pay. And to be honest, you know, you can have some sympathy for local media companies trying to face this challenge, which is really quite significant. I mean, how do they, you know, reinvent themselves to deal with the current media market? But at the same time, just, you know, yelling out for government to come to the rescue and put more funding in is not the answer.
Well, you could argue that we could just find out. And I guess reality check radio is in some ways a serious attempt to do that, to find out what happens when you are not beholden to advertisers and you can have a commitment to speaking the truth. As Rob said earlier, the disappearance of News Hub for all its disappointments leaves us with John Campbell, Katie Bradford and other less freedom, more government, hard-left journalists proselytizing at the public who fund them.
They should take a look at themselves rather than blaming international factors. You know, Labor, everything wrong in our economy, according to Grant Robertson, was Putin's fault. It was COVID's fault. It's the weather's fault with, you know, weather events. And the journalists are doing the same. They're blaming international factors. There are plenty of super successful media companies in the world. You know, not long ago, the Herald reported the news and there was one column, which was the opinion by the editor that was headed up, the editor's opinion. Now practically every piece in papers like the Herald is an opinion piece by a journalist. It's their opinion on a minister saying they're a moron, they're an idiot. And I don't think Kiwis are actually remotely interested in their stupid opinions. They should take a look at themselves. We've had a gutsful of listening to their opinions. They're biased. They're trying to push an agenda. And we just don't want to hear from them. And if you want an opinion, go on social media. That's fantastic. There are a billion opinions out there, actually many of them way better than most of the journalists who've been working for the mainstream media outlets. So they should take a look at themselves. There are highly profitable media companies in the world. There are whole books that it doesn't seem any of our mainstream media have read, that the future is not for them trying to get people to pay for content they won't. It's connecting up their users. Several million people visit the Herald website every week. Several million people. And the game is joining and connecting the users. Yeah. Like trading, they're buying and selling. They've got different views. In fact, if anything, I actually have seen comment sections in the Herald where people were getting a bit of a sort of a leading up to the election, bashing the government. And the Herald shut down the comments. It's like, we don't want our users talking to each other. You might get someone who's an anti-vaxxer or some disgusting person who, you know, and we'll have to get Jacinda Ardern on it to shut down these malicious rumors or something. You know, but this is what people want. They want to talk with each other and connect.
Well, about a week ago, Winston Peters questioned why One News had ignored the new COVID inquiry and effectively raised questions about the adequacy of government-funded journalists to hold their paymasters to account. And I'll read, it's worth reading his post on X. One News has not reported once on the COVID inquiry announcement that was made on Monday. Not one story, article, question, or comment on their website, social media apps, or TV news. ZB, RNZ, Herald, News Hub, and every other media outlet not only reported it on Monday, they have had follow-up articles and interviews throughout the week, but not a single mention from One News. Why? You would think the new COVID-19 Royal Commission and the government's first use of the agree-to-disagree provision would be of public interest enough to report it, even just once, but not a single mention from One News. This is your taxpayer-funded news. Maybe it's time we start asking them why. Is this reluctance, do you think, to report on this story a result of having public media having their sleeve caught in the machinery of what's being reviewed, or is it the fear that with the benefit of hindsight they may find that they were too aligned to the podium of truth?
Well, they already know the truth, don't they? That it was a wonderful, roaring success.
Saved 20,000 lives.
Yeah, but I think that this whole approach is just a continuation of everything that they did during the whole COVID 3 years, where they never questioned anything that was being done. Never the news media. I really agree with what Rob just said about how they should take a look at themselves, because really, everybody's so aware now that what we're getting is completely biased reporting, particularly from TV One. As I say, most people have kind of given up and switched off, but it's almost, become too boring to even keep talking about the fact that we're getting such biased coverage. But this is just a repeat of the fact that they completely ignored it. Is a repeat of what they have been doing for the last few years. They completely ignored the fact that, you know, when a prime minister gets up and says, "We are your single source of truth," that should strike terror into the heart of every academic and every decent journalist in the country. But it was never questioned. And when she said, "Yes, we're going to have two classes of people based on your willingness to get injected with an experimental genetic product," that was never questioned. So, I mean, they've just, and the fact that they're ignoring it now just entrenches, everybody has to conclude that they're just doubling down, as they are doubling down on any kind of opposition to any aspect of what people now are referring to as the omni-cause. Or the whatever you want to call it, the current narrative on anything, the new orthodoxy. There's always been, you know, an increasing approach over the last 20 years to either ignore or blatantly denigrate any kind of questioning that's not what on the list of items that or approaches that they agree with and want to cover.
Yeah, it occurred to me recently, and it hit me like a thunderbolt, that people who complain about conspiracy theorists don't examine them, weigh them up against the available evidence and dismiss them. They're afraid of anything that challenges their idea of reality and homeostasis. And the media has very much become an agency of that, hasn't it? And I think also a factor that, you know, if they paused for self-respect, reflection, as you said, Rob, the unrelenting alarmism. And I've started reading Michael Schellenberger's, I've added it to my teetering pile of books on my bedside table, his 2020 book, Apocalypse Never, which is a really great examination of the veracity of so many of the claims that just feature all the time. And anytime some adverse weather event can be linked to unstoppable anthropogenic climate change, they do. And it pulls apart so many of those, the sky is falling, received wisdoms trotted out daily by New Zealand's media lovies. I also started reading The New Puritans, which is also instructive. Andrew Doyle's 2022 book. And they provide a very interesting series of insights into what's perhaps driving some of that orthodoxy that we've fallen into.
Yes, but I think it's Yeah, exactly. And I mean, a lot of the references, the New Puritans book is really interesting, as you say. But I think it's more than that, because not only has journalism become opinion-based, and as Rob was saying, all the articles that you see, they're basically opinions, but the media has also become the primary mechanism for censorship of opinion. So it's not just the fact that we're getting biased reporting and that they don't provide a proper balanced approach to the facts or reporting the facts. You only get one side of that. But they're also censoring opinions. So there's obviously a clear set of opinions that they don't like. And basically they choose to not feature those.
Mm. I mean, the Inquiry was, I mean, Winston, as we all known him for decades, is probably the wiliest old fox in Kiwi politics. And he made his name, of course, with the Winebox Inquiry. Back the old Faye Richwhite investigation as to over taxes. And so inquiries have, you know, he's made incredible political mileage out of them. So it seems they want to do a second inquiry after this one, and maybe he has some plans over that. I think the Kiwi public are just fed up with COVID and, you know, don't want to read a 1,000-page report. Ardern is effectively living in exile now. She's just so unpopular in the country. And, I mean, I'd like to see, if there was an inquiry, something maybe along the lines more of what the British are doing. Boris Johnson had to come along. It's a public inquiry where they have to testify in front of, you know, members of parliament and do it in front of the cameras. And the Americans are good at this. I think probably Ardern should be required to attend. If she doesn't want to, she should be legally subpoenaed, and she should be cross-examined on exactly what she did. In my opinion, the mishandling of the second lockdown in Auckland at the end of 2021 cost the country tens of billions of dollars. It was a catastrophic mistake. Hipkins is as good as admitted that locking us down way into 2022, it just went on too far. And we want to, maybe there is mileage to get to the bottom of that, but I think it should be on public display on the TV screens. And that group of people, get them all in, get Wiles and Hendy, and get the whole group of them in and have some ferocious cross-examining of them and subpoena them and make sure they have to attend. But don't just write a 1,000-page report that everyone's bored.
You could get there with just a few carefully chosen questions. I've often thought, you know, if you had the data on health outcomes by vaccination status, why did you initially promise to release it and then withhold it? If you knew that there was an indication in the initial Pfizer data that this could lead to myocarditis and possibly some problems in pregnancy, why did you threaten doctors who cautioned their patients on such things? You could that's quite a string you could start pulling on.
And they're asking those questions in Britain. They're getting some of the most eminent epidemiologists, way more eminent than any of ours, way more eminent than Baker and Otago. And they're coming. They've been hauled in front of the members of parliament in Britain, and they've said things like, "Look, the if you're a healthy young child, the chance of you dying from COVID is like 0.00001%. And parents who, you know, they weren't, that there was a time they knew that it was incredibly low. And in fact, if you're a young child, it may have been better not to be vaccinated, given that extremely low risk that for children. But there was evidence coming out in Britain that they withheld that information. They said, you know, we had the children couldn't go to school here unless they were vaccinated. And parents were very sort of worried about that. There are a lot of legitimate questions, and there's a lot of new evidence that has come out about that. And what did the government know about that? I think it should be public, and I think Ardern should be hauled back to the country to explain herself, because I think the majority of Kiwis are angry and mad at her to the extent she is living in exile. And I think that she should personally have to come back and an answer for what she did.
Well, it's worth looking at where she's gone. You know, you were talking earlier about the act of censorship. She's gone to the dark heart of that academically. Mm. Anyway, Harvard has formed a new discipline around misinformation that has taken her on. And it's a multidisciplinary approach that they say is too big to fail. And and that's a nexus of intelligence communities, financial interests, the pharmaceutical companies figure in it, in the studies, probably to run interference for anyone who's criticizing what they're doing. So the fact that she's gone to found that as her home tells us an awful lot. And you know, that combines with things like NewsGuard, which are already altering what information's flowing through to people. I mean, you know, some of those three-letter agencies have been affecting the algorithm since 2017 using AI. So there's a lot of things we're up against in this that that aren't widely discussed. It's a
I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I've been vaccinated. I'm no anti-vaxxer at all. But I would say she should be held to account. It's you know, it's not good enough that she can just float off and not be accountable. And Grant Robertson and Hipkins, he was the COVID minister. I want to see an inquiry where those folks are cross-examined.
I think there are just so many questions that just referring back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, Rob, about how the New Zealand public is just over the whole COVID thing. Unfortunately, you know, we can't allow that to ensure that we don't have a proper inquiry. And I think when you look at what's actually been announced about this, I think they've done the politically expedient thing in allowing the current Royal Commission to continue with its very limited and restricted terms of reference. And they'll let the thing come to its conclusion. They'll write a report, which will just be an input, hopefully, into phase two. But I thoroughly agree with you. You know, the previous politicians, the previous core group who basically spearheaded the whole COVID approach in New Zealand for the Labor government, should be hauled back to answer questions. And but I have to feel a sense of optimism about what's been announced. Hopefully what they're calling phase two will be a lot more independent. And the words that give me hope are things, several things that have been included that were specifically excluded from the previous, from the existing Royal Commission's terms of reference. And that includes vaccine efficacy and safety. It includes consideration about the effect of the mandates and the lockdowns. It will have to include vaccine harm statistics and health outcomes when you look at those two things, and as well as the economic impacts on the country, but also the words public inquiry give me hope that we may well be able to have a situation where people are able, well, first of all, people who have been affected will actually be allowed to tell their story, because nothing has emerged of that over the last few years. The news media have never done any articles featuring or trying to investigate incidents of vaccine harm. So these people will be allowed, I hope, to front up and tell their story properly, and for those statistics to be investigated. The news media has never featured, for example, two lots of statistics that have been running all the time that they could have chosen to investigate were the number of AC claims that were being approved for vaccine harm. But that's never been featured on the on TV1 or Radio New Zealand or any of the rest of them. Secondly, nobody's ever referred to the Ministry of Health statistics on vaccination status and case numbers and COVID deaths. That's never been featured. So hopefully these things will at least be given an airing under this phase two.
Sorry, Rob?
I watched the video of Ardern speaking at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and she said that during lockdowns, children, of course, were online all the time. And she said, I know a clinical psychologist, I think a Kiwi one, and he was saying, look, it doesn't matter. She said, it doesn't matter if they're online. She said the parents were also concerned. And she said, don't worry, they're going to be okay. We have clinical psychology evidence that time online. Well, what a load of nonsense. And she laughed and the audience clapped. I mean, I teach these kids now, the COVID generation coming through. This year, they were the students completely disengaged. We had turnout of sort of 10 to 20% of the class. Most of them are staying in bed all day and not coming into the classes at the university. It's noticeable the devastating effects that these lockdowns have had being online and on screen. And there is now evidence around the world that the COVID generation in Britain are going to be permanently harmed in terms of career prospects, mental health. All their educational outcomes are shockingly lower than the others. So to sort of dismissively for her to say, I know a sort of a clinical psychologist in Morrinsville, and he said it's all going to be okay. It's just utter nonsense. I mean, I think she should be held to account on these false claims she's continuing to make about the effects on young people.
Probably continuing to make knowing that they're false. I remember when COVID first started, I was actually doing a paper which was run out of the University of Waikato Education Department. So I was with a lot of teachers, and a lot of them at that early stage were very worried about their students. They were seeing suicidal ideation, if not suicide attempts, just go through the roof. And I remember going through the supermarket without a mask and seeing children just staring at me wide-eyed, and I was thinking, what's going on here?
Why did we turn into a totalitarian country overnight?
I think, I mean, the most obvious, and the fact that it's not reported is chilling to someone who is struggling with a vaccine injury, the total denial of the reality.
What Rob was just talking about, I think it's tragic what happened in education through the whole COVID lockdowns, and it has had an ongoing impact. You know, it's not only, you know, school children who were mainly working online. It's all the people who were denied access to universities because they weren't vaccinated. You know, it compromised their degree work. You know, I've got family members who were in this situation. Questions have to be asked, and I hope that the right questions will be asked. And I hope that the right people are called back to be held to account and have questions asked of them. Because one of the things that occurred during this whole period, and it's been reflected in the media, is incredible arrogance that neither the politicians nor the media seem to think that they should be held to account for their performance.
Yeah, well, what you said earlier, people are just bored, they don't want to hear it. There is a certain type, you know, a certain segment of the population that does just go along to get along, and undoubtedly they're bored. But
Stanley Milgram's 65% is always going to be a factor.
We're heading up against time now. Another thing that came up was and this is relating again to the bias of state media. There was the issue with Mikey Sherman's celebratory reporting of the previous TVNZ Varian poll that showed a drop in support for the coalition government, and it received 309 complaints. And it was, when you watch it, it was a bit like Katie Bradford's Freudian slip in a previous election when she said, no matter what we talk about, no matter what we do, the polls don't seem to shift at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mikey Sherman, Much Mackay. I mean, basically, you know, this continuation of TV presenters continuing to lecture the public about what they think we should think, and putting on, you know, people whose opinions they want to hear. Oh, you know. But I said, I was talking before about opinion polls, and basically, you know, the staff of TV One don't seem to realise that there's been a change of government. So anything that's against the government, and just as an aside comment, I'm interested in the terminology that's being used where they refer to the government as the coalition all the time. We've had coalition government since MMP first came in, and I've never seen a situation where they keep calling the government the coalition. What is that? I think it's quite deliberate that they're actually wanting to convey that this is a sort of an unstable alignment of three separate parties that's bound to fail, and if they can help them fail before the next election, that would be a really good outcome.
Well, I mean, journalists have become so obsessed with the colour of skin, they've very much neglected the content of character, haven't they? And as I said earlier, journalism saturated with those more government, less freedom folks on the left. And having worked in a newsroom, I can also say a lot of them are functionally innumerate often. They go through arts degrees and don't do a lot of maths. And there's that Worlds of Journalism study that came out, as I mentioned earlier, found that 81% of New Zealand's journalists identified as left of centre, with just 15% identifying as right of centre. And I don't think people who have the less government, more freedom way of seeing things necessarily want it that way in inverse, but 50-50 would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but it's also, they're not only politically innumerate, but also politically inadequate. For instance, if you're going to be a senior political commentator in a very visible media post, I would have thought that there would be some knowledge requirement, you know, that you would need to have undertaken degree political studies or political science, or looked at, you know, government policy making in some way. But these are, like I say, I mean, that's happening with politicians too. The previous prime minister was a communications graduate, and it seems that the universities are turning out communications graduates who seem to think that they have an automatic right into journalism. And, you know, where's the knowledge? This is why I think RCR is doing so well, because the range of information that's been shared publicly by people who are knowledgeable people who can comment with some degree of expertise about things, you know, it's been encouraging to see that, because that's not what the media does.
Well, it's been a great thing to be a part of, and seeing it from the inside as well, how committed everyone is, as I said, to basically telling the truth and getting to the truth through talking to people who know what they're talking about. It's pretty simple, and I guess it's originally the way journalism was, and hopefully, as I said, if we can not distort the market too much, we might get back to that.
Let's hope.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that lack of tolerance for dissenting views, we're seeing that within Māori media as well, possibly to a greater extent. There was another thing that came up for discussion. Māori television reporter Will Trafford, who quit Māori, it's now called something else, isn't it? Whakaata Māori, formerly Māori Television, after they pulled a story about the red flags concerning the operation of a polling booth at Manurewa Marae at the general election. So I don't think we need to recap that, but Te Pāti Māori candidate Taku Tai Tash Kemp, who won the Māori seat of Tamaki Makaurau by just 40 votes, was the CEO of that Mariah. And apparently the story was pulled for lack of balance after John Tamahiri got in contact with his friend Shane Taurima, who's the CEO. Where do we think that's going to end up? Is it being taken seriously enough? I mean, you could argue also with the use of imagery of firearms and flames and talk of revolution. Are we too afraid to call that out for what it is, which is sort of ethno-nationalism?
Well, clearly, because that kind of commentary is not happening. And, you know, I think New Zealanders are tired of the whole Te Pāti Māori jumping up and down about, you know, what they see as anti-Māori in actions by the current government. Just demonstrates where John Tamahiri's tentacles reach, which seems to be all over the place. I used to quite admire John Tamahiri because I remember going to hear him at various conferences in the 1990s, and he used to chuck off about the brown aristocracy and the iwi supremacy, because you know his thing was urban Māori, and you know he was brassed off that all the Crown settlements, treaty settlements were going to iwi, and he wasn't getting a look in. But then
now he's got a look in.
Well, he found out how to get into the trough, and he's moved it very successfully.
Robert, have you got any thoughts on that?
You know, to be fair to Māori media, this is all media are playing this game. The view, it's been proven now in media economics that the media is a business like any other business. You know, Radio Check Radio have a group of viewers with certain views. And if you start running stories which offend the views of your viewers, they turn off. So, you know, it's like selling any product. You have your market and your customers. In America, if you're right wing, you don't really like watching CNN. You will go to Fox News. You don't want to hear views that completely contradict your view. So you have the spectrum of sort of left-right channels, and there is a really endemic problem of objectivity now because they're playing to their market. And if you're Māori TV, you don't want to offend your primarily Māori audience. And by the way, on my blog, if I do left-wing articles that have a sort of a left-wing tilt that are bashing the government, I notice that the left-wing outlets will pick them up. Gladly. But if I do something that's on the side of ACT or the Nats, they won't touch it. But equally, if you look at blogs like Bassett, Brash and Hyde, if I do an article criticizing the Nats or ACT, typically they won't pick up the article. They have their own viewers and they don't like putting in stuff, which, you know, I've done an article today sort of bashing essentially ANZ Bank, that it's sort of becoming, you know, too big and too powerful. Well, you know, they're not going to put that up on Bassett, Brash and Hyde. They like the banks there, and Don Brash has all his views on everything. So they're playing to their own audience, and that's a problem in the media, and it's worldwide. You know, it's a problem of objectivity. They're all playing to their market.
Catherine, before we go, can you give us some of that hope that you've been sprinkling through the discussion today?
Hope about the media. Well, I mean, Rob has, you know, raised a couple of really, really challenging points. And this question of bias is an interesting one, because obviously we all have our own opinions and we like to see stuff that reinforces those opinions. It's natural. So, of course, that translates into media coverage. But I think... you know, there are some wider questions It's a pity we haven't had time in this interview to talk about the coverage this week of the government's new housing package, because we could really go to town on that. And I hope perhaps there'll be a further opportunity to talk about
maybe
that.
We'll schedule a chat for you with Paul Brennan or...
I think we should. But just going back to the main points, the question of biases is a complicated one. But I think, you know, somewhere it comes back to the issues of standards. It's not that hard to actually provide balanced coverage of things. And, I mean, I was just looking at the BBC coverage on some things recently, and you know, I was working overseas for a long period of time, and we used to watch BBC World all the time. And they have become increasingly biased and left-wing focused in their coverage. And you can notice the difference. I mean, even 10 years ago, when they reported an item, they would try to speak to you know, commentators on both sides of the argument. And, you know, sometimes that was a bit ridiculous because they'd select somebody who was at the extreme end of either side of the argument. But they did make an effort to do that. Now they don't even bother. And that's what's, you know, that's what we're seeing. So some return to standards, I think, you know, has to be looked at as a fundamental aspect of media coverage. You can't just go on, you know, having unlicensed and unpopular bias across every platform. And one approach is to have a range of different platforms that then give you, you know, a range of opinions and commentary. But that that leaves people themselves to, you know, to use their own discernment and looking at a range of opinions, but, you know, and probably most people won't do that because they just don't have the time to be delving across, you know, lots of different websites and reading articles. And, you know, this is a fact of our new information environment as well. You know, we've got this kind of sound bites fixation across everything. So there are some very difficult challenges, but I think somebody needs to get back to a look at basic standards for everything, and not just media coverage, but also political behaviour as well.
Amen. Rob, any quick thought before we sign out?
Well, I think Kate's, you know, spot on with that comment, because in the case of One News, if you're going to be a rabidly biased left wing pushing your agenda, what's the point of having a state-owned broadcaster that's doing that? I mean, there are plenty of blogs and radio stations out there pushing their own agendas. The whole point of a state-subsidized outlet, whether it's the BBC or One News, is to provide that objectivity that Kate's referring to, and both sides. And if they're not going to do that, I don't see any point that they exist. They should just, you know, join the club of all the other, you know, biased channels. So I think at that level, One News is just lost its right to exist.
Well, it's a great place to leave it today. Professor Rob McCulloch, thanks so much for joining us here on Fourth Estate. And Catherine Ennis-Carter, thanks also. I've really enjoyed hearing your views on New Zealand's media, and I'll let you skip out into that Wellington sunshine before it clouds over.
2 degrees where I am right now.
Oh, well, put your socks on. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marty.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Fourth Estate right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio. Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.